25. I was strongly considering chapters 25 and 26 because it's doable for one evening, and I really would eventually like to make some progress through the book of Genesis. We're doing okay, but I'd like to make some progress through the book of Genesis. So we'll jump into that in just a second. A lot of great little things in this chapter, and hope to pick it apart a little bit. Don't want to be here all night. You know, we'll be here for 20 minutes, and no. But if you didn't get the memo, my apologies for it being a little bit on the late side, but there's an update on church website, Facebook, Twitter, church app. We'll direct you to that, and what else? I don't know, I guess that's it. But yeah, City of Rogers passed an ordinance unanimously, kind of a late afternoon, early evening session. That ordinance passed in Rogers that they're asking everyone to wear masks in public places. You know, our governor announced something on Friday the 3rd, that he was leaving it up to different cities to enforce that if they wanted to enforce that. And so the City of Rogers convened on Monday via Zoom, and you can actually watch it's a city council meeting, so it's public, and they posted it, so you can watch that. And there should be a link on the website to that. So we're gonna follow that. And man, this thing's not going away. The United States, we just passed 3 million confirmed cases. Of course, that's not 3 million people that have it right now, but that's 3 million confirmed cases. Are we at 130? I want to say we're close to, if not having surpassed, 130,000 people that have died from this thing. So it's not just going away. So that's what our city deems appropriate, and we're going to follow suit. The luxury, somehow, because this is Jake's demonstrating, right? No, you're good. It's because it's thin right now. You know, we had a new family or two on Sunday morning, and I you know, just chit-chatting with them after service, and kind of like, I can't wait for you to meet the rest of our congregation. You know, just so like. And by the way, everybody at home, love you, miss you, and you're fine. Stay home. Do whatever you need to do. So, you know, the upside of this right now, we can feel pretty good about spreading out. So it's kind of, if you can't do that, if you can't practice social distancing, that's what they've asked. And I think we can do pretty good in here with social distancing for, you know, 45 minutes or an hour. And there you go. So no other announcements other than... No other announcements. There's nothing else to announce. Yeah, good question. Next Wednesday night will be a study from the book of Psalms. And then the following Wednesday night, if everything goes according to plan, we'll have a movie, which will be, and I talked about this on Sunday. Did I talk? Yeah, I did. Where it's more of, it's actually, and I'll let Jake talk about it in 2 weeks, but the movie is more dealing with, interesting conversation in today's day and age, but freedom of speech. And the freedom of speech where you have all these professors at major universities that believe in intelligent design. And they were like losing their jobs. They were being booted off of the campuses, losing tenure, all these kinds of things. So Ben Stein, Jewish man, non-Christian in any way, he's a former presidential speechwriter, and for my generation, he would be, of course, the great high school teacher in a certain 1980s movie that would have asked on numerous occasions, Bueller. Bueller. He's sick. So classic. So I can't believe I'm talking about Ferris Bueller right now. But so he is that guy. So he has nothing to do with, this is an interesting thing, especially from a church vantage point, but nothing to do with Christianity. But his argument was, why are all these professors losing their jobs? Look, if intelligent design is the kookiest, craziest, dumbest thing on the planet, then no, it should not be taught in major universities. But if there's anything to it, why are these professors not allowed freedom of speech? If there's anything scientifically to it, then they should have the room to discuss that. So he just started digging into it, and the deeper he dug, the more he realized, Not only is intelligent design rational, logical, scientific, but when you really weigh it against the, you can't even call evolution a theory because it can't be tested, but the idea of evolution, it's like it's not even a comparison. The lack of scientific anything, and I'll just go on record to say that the lack of scientific anything for evolution is jarring. So he's looking at it going, these guys are losing their jobs over something that actually makes sense, and these guys are promoting this thing that you actually cannot defend. So where it's an interesting thing for us is, why would we watch that? Because it gives us some good answers, number one, but number two, it also kind of gives us a glimpse into the secular mind, like what people are thinking. And it's, I don't know, what would you say, Jake, about 10 years old-ish, maybe more?
Almost 15.
So this is what people have been thinking for quite some time, and this is probably when you're talking to people and you mention anything about the Bible, they already lose faith in the value of the conversation because they think you believe in myths or something, which is actually somewhat in keeping of what we're going to discuss tonight, because this is not mythological. So at any rate, that's 2 weeks from now. And it's a good one. We'll get to that. So Lord, would you bless our evening? Thank you that we can gather, and we would ask for, oh man, I know, and I've talked about this before, where these prayers don't make a lot of sense. Just bless the whole world. So our prayer is not just bless the whole world, because we know where this is all going. But we would like to ask for your mercy. We would like to ask for a further extension of your grace. We would also like to ask, and this is kind of either baffling to us or super obvious to us, why scientists around the world cannot figure out what's going on with this virus. It's either because there's a lot of spiritual undertone to it, and as things are approaching the end times, it's a bigger conversation, Lord, but you know. But we would like to ask that you would give wisdom to these scientists, and may they have the wisdom to ask you for your wisdom. If we're depending on human wisdom alone, we are all in big trouble. So we'd ask for you to grant them wisdom, ask that you would somehow stir their hearts and minds to seek you for your wisdom. Draw hearts to you during this day and age. Use us, the church, as you would see fit. We would love to see revival, which would be before the world kind of hears about you and hears the gospel, that the church would be stirred, the church would be awakened, the church would be active, alive, ready, available. So for our time this evening, and these things are also applicable, please do speak to us. We commit it all to you and pray all of it in the precious name of Jesus. Amen. Chapter 25, book of Genesis, verse 1 says, Abraham, right, again took a wife, and her name was Keturah. So Sarah had died, she was buried. Abraham probably realizing, and we looked at this last week, if Sarah died and she was 10 years my younger, I'm no spring chicken here, and Isaac probably needs to get a wife eventually too, so I want to make sure he doesn't go back to the land, and that was what we discussed last week. So, you know, he's probably thinking, my time is drawing to a close, only he apparently had a little bit more life left in him. He took a wife, and her name was Keturah, and she bore him, and here's some sons of theirs, Zimran, Yokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shuah. So pause there. This is still Abraham, right? And he's still blessed with many children. And so that wasn't just limited to Isaac, nor to Isaac and Ishmael, but of course he's blessed with children. And again, yeah, he's an old guy at this point. So here are some of his kids, and this is part of the genealogy of them. So verse 3, Yokshan begot Sheba, and Dedan, and the sons of Dedan were Ashurim, Latushim, and Laumim, or Loemim. And the sons of Midian were Ephah, Epher, Hanoch, Abidah, and Eldaah. And these were the children of Keturah. Like, okay, Moses authored this for us. Thanks a lot, Moses. We really appreciate that. But this is actually important. Again, the overriding story of the Bible and the overriding story of the book of Genesis is, in a word, redemption. So this is the line by which redemption would come. And this redemption will come through and has come through Messiah, through Jesus Christ. Thus, all these other genealogy that we read in the book of Genesis, and I think I've said this before, but they're two things. They're both important and unimportant. What? Can you say that? Yeah, you could say that. They're important because they are people, and again, this is not mythology. This is actual history. This is what else happened with Abraham, and this was his other wife, Keturah, and these were their kids, etc., etc. So they're important. It's history. But in this sense, not them, but their genealogy is unimportant in the sense of the story of redemption will be for them, but it's not from them. And this will make more sense as we move along, not just through this chapter, but through the whole of the book of Genesis. It's for them, but it's not from them. And again, just as a side note here, it's worth a mention. If this is mythology, and therefore it's mythology to signify or symbolize or point to something else, then all of these side notes would be totally unnecessary. It's just an interesting whole sub-conversation. So verse 5. And Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac. Why? Because, of course, he was the son of promise, and to the son of promise would go the inheritance, and he would be the heir. But, verse 6, Abraham gave gifts to the sons of the concubines which Abraham had, and while he was still living, he sent them eastward, away from Isaac his son, to the country of the east. So two things there in verse 6 quickly. He gives gifts and blessings, and there's always blessing through this man, Abraham. But also it's worth noting, as he sent them away, he's like, well, that seems mean. No, sent them away in the country to the east. This would be back to towards where he originated. But further, you know, regardless of where they went, this land would not be for them. This is for Isaac and his descendants to follow. So, love you guys, but it's time to go. Verse 7. This is the sum of the years of Abraham's life which he lived. 175 years. And don't get me started on this, but not only can I not imagine living that long, but ugh, in today's world? Oh, brother. I mean, I'm not asking that the Lord would take me out tonight, nor would I complain if he did, you know, but 175 years, a long, full life, different days, probably better then than it is now, which is crazy. All our technology makes things better. All of our education. 175 years. And then, verse 8, Abraham breathed his last and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people. And his sons Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave of Machpelah, which is before Mamre, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar the Hittite, in the field which Abraham purchased from the sons of Heth. And we looked at that, of course, recently. There Abraham was buried, and Sarah, his wife, breathed his last. If you're a King James, do we have King James people in here on Wednesday night? If you're a King James person, it says that he gave up his ghost, or he gave up his spirit. Interesting. It's interesting for a couple of reasons. As it says in the New King James and probably a lot of your other translations, he breathed his last. Interesting that the word breathed and spirit, it's the same word in Hebrew, ruach. What's interesting is that's not the word that's used here. So the expression here is that he breathed his last, or he gave up the ghost. This is just in no uncertain terms. There's nothing terribly flowery about it. He died. You know, that's about it. So it's a literal, he breathed his last. What is fascinating, though, is this concept, and I especially like it there in the King James, he gave up the ghost, or he gave up his spirit. In the New Testament, of course, we have 2 Peter, and Peter talking about not so much this life, but but our lives in this body and our body being a tent. And the tent is a temporary dwelling place. And if you've ever grew up camping and you go into your garage, like, yeah, it's time to dust off the old tent. And like, oh man, there's a couple more holes in the old tent this year. And we're missing a couple tent spikes and, you know, whatever. Like, oh man, we need to fix that zipper. And man, it's just a mess. And it's a great actual parallel and a great picture that Peter provides for us there in 2 Peter, that our bodies are that tent. They are a temporary dwelling place. We're not designed to be in them forever, especially post Genesis chapter 3 and the fall. So when it's time and our tent has kind of wore out, it's time to go. Abraham, 175 years in his tent. It was time to move on from it. Interesting, because if we're really going to get into this, it wasn't for him to move from his tent, from his body, to heaven, right? Because as a patriarch, they were looking forward in faith to the coming of Messiah. Just as we on this side of the cross look back in faith to Messiah, to Jesus Christ. And so heaven wasn't open yet, and he had to wait for, again, Messiah and specifically redemption to come. Thus, if you remember so much of our conversation in recent months and whatnot from our studies in Hebrews, these all looked forward in faith to the coming of the Savior. In fact, it's a great side note. If you want to dig into it, Luke chapter 16, which I do not believe to be a parable, offers some details about what Hades would be, the place of the dead pre-cross, where you had Lazarus, you know, the poor man that died, and he found himself resting and being comforted in Abraham's bosom. Hades, everyone there waiting for Messiah, and the unrighteous dead wishing, man, hey, Abraham, could you just reach over, dude? Could you just give me a drop of water to quench the agony? Can't do it. Can't do it. So for us now as believers, well, it's 2 Corinthians chapter 5, isn't it? 2 Corinthians chapter 5, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. And if you guys, any of you guys know my testimony, I know it's a similar testimony to some of you in here, growing up Roman Catholic, purgatory, except there's no such thing at all, and the Bible mentions nothing of it. And actually, it's an interesting study when we get to Mark's gospel, and we'll get to this soon in Mark chapter 7, which is just around the corner in our study on Sundays, where Jesus's complaint with the religious leaders, of course, is that they held their tradition, the tradition of men, over and above the word of God. He said, all too well, you reject the commandment of God that you may keep your tradition. Religion's good at that. So purgatory, it's a good kind of a in-between, except it doesn't exist. It's wrong. It's a lie. So pre-cross, there was this abode, this place of waiting, but now that Jesus has delivered them from there, from Hades, and of course this would be a great study if you want to dig into it in Ephesians chapter 4, Messiah released them, Jesus set them free at his death when he went and preached and brought release to those who were held captive, just waiting for that. Whole interesting conversation. So, at any rate, what are we talking about? Well, we're talking about Abraham breathed his last, right? He breathed his last, and he's buried, as we see there in verse 10, with Sarah. Interesting side note even with that. Isn't that fascinating? Like, the more you dig into this, the more you see all these little elements. This is the only spot, and I think we probably talked about this. We talked about this last week or the week before when, in chapter 23, right? When Abraham purchased that plot of land for Sarah's burial. The only plot of land that he ever owned, you know, in human terms, in the promised land, burial place. Isn't that interesting? I need a place to bury us when our time has come. Interesting. So, came to pass, verse 11, after the death of Abraham, that God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac dwelt at Beer Lahai Roy. And of course, this is where we last saw him, back in chapter 24 and verse 62. Isaac came from the way of Beer Lahai Roy, for he dwelt in the south. And as his wife was brought to him, this is the last place we saw him, and this is where he lives. This is the well of him who lives and sees. And then, again, because this book is giving us some historic details, we now get the initial genealogy of Ishmael, verse 12. Now, this is the genealogy of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's maidservant, bore to Abraham. And these were the names of the sons of Ishmael by their names according to their generations. The firstborn of Ishmael, Nebayoth, then Kedar, Adbiel, Mibsam, Mishma, Duma, Masa, Hadar, Tema, Yatur, Nafish, and Kedema. These were the sons of Ishmael, and they were, and these were their names by their towns and their settlements, and that's obviously still common. You know, you name places after people. And 12 princes, says, according to their nations. These were the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years, and he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people. And then this little note that Moses provides for us in verse 18, they dwelt from Havilah as far as Shur, which is east of Egypt as you go towards Assyria. He died in the presence of all his brethren. So again, anything important? Well, yeah, there's obvious historic value. What happened to Ishmael? This blessed 12 tribes of children, and so a great genealogy, great descendants, and of course he was of the line of Abraham. Abraham's his dad, right? So he's blessed as well. But we drop off the story of Ishmael here, because now we're going to follow the line of Abraham specifically through the son of promise, Isaac. It's interesting, isn't it? Like, a lot of times we read this like, can I say this from the pulpit? This is super boring, but it's important because there are actual people in it, so it just further reinforces the historic value of it. So Ishmael dies, he's buried. And this is the genealogy, verse 19, of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begot Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah as wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban the Syrian. So here now we really start the story about Isaac. And essentially from this point on, right, if you want to break down Genesis into some really simple chunks, you have creation, then you have the fall, and then of course you have the flood, then the Tower of Babel, and that brings us to Abraham, and then here to Isaac. And then and really almost immediately after this, and we're introduced to his sons, Jacob and Esau. So Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and then finally, in a big chunk of the book of Genesis, Joseph. It's like, if you really want to break down kind of the book of Genesis, that's the eight essential elements. Interesting is Isaac's the son of promise. There's just not, if we're going to put this in modern vernacular, he doesn't get a lot of screen time. Like, anything else? I mean, this is Abraham's son, and he's there, and he's important, obviously, but these other characters obviously get a little bit more emphasis. Fascinating stuff. So Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. So he was 40 when he marries her, and he's begging the Lord for children. The Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. This is an interesting thing, and it's a side note, but it's one that's so common throughout the halls of Scripture. The emphasis here, prayer, that he would seek the Lord, and seeking the Lord not as a last resort. I won't ask for a show of hands because I'm afraid that you guys are, well, I'm afraid of one of two things. Either you're just like me, or you're better than me, and that's going to make me feel bad, right? But it's like, we're so good at making prayer, like, well, I've tried everything else. Hey, God, what do you think? I was hoping you'd, you know, like, if we start there, it shouldn't be a last resort, and that's a whole great other conversation. So he begs the Lord, he pleads with the Lord, can we please have a child? The Lord granted his plea, Rebekah, his wife, conceived, but, that's a tough contrast, verse 22, but the children struggled together within her, with the children, plural, and she said, if all is well, why am I like this? Like, thanks for the baby, but what is happening? And as you fast forward through the lives, and, you know, spoiler alert, right? These two boys don't exactly get along, and that will carry on through, you know, time and space kind of thing. They don't get along. So what is happening here? Why am I like this? So what does she do? She went to inquire of the Lord. Same thing. Lord, what's happening? There's this like battle royale happening inside of me. She prays, and God again responds. And the Lord said to her, so fascinating, what does it say here in terms of how he spoke? It doesn't. So vision doesn't say that. Dream does not say that. Audibly doesn't say it. And that's a whole nother side note. If you really want to dig into it as your own personal study, the different ways that the Lord spoke to his people, specifically in the Old Testament. Either way, he spoke to her. He said to her, to nations. For you moms, you know, like, oh, two nations, not just two kids. Twins would be rough, but two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. So it's from the Lord. So in that regard, this isn't like her giving a prophetic word to someone else. So this is clearly prophetic because it's God speaking to her about what is to come. And this is what we know. And of course, we know this happens from God to Rebekah. And the basis of this is foreknowledge. He knows what's going to happen. He's telling her about what is to come. Even if you fast forward again in the New Testament, especially Romans and the book of Ephesians, the basis of predestination would be God's foreknowledge. It's God announcing what will happen. And in his sovereignty, he tells us what is to come. Here with Jacob and Esau, and we can keep reading this, but here with these two, the Edomites would come through him. Let's keep reading. Verse 24, when her days were fulfilled for her to give birth, indeed, there were twins in her womb, and the first came out red. He was like a hairy garment all over. So they called his name Esau, and you want to guess what Esau means? It means hairy. Hey, Harry, how you doing? Man, it's like, that's just your name. Get over it. You know, tough luck there, buddy. And of course, it's a fascinating study, and this one always gets me in chapter 27. If you read ahead, don't read ahead right now, but how hairy was the guy where brother Jacob like puts on the, you know, like the goat skin on his neck, and dad is like, well, you sound like Jacob, but man, you're like, how hairy was this guy? So at any rate, came out red. He was like a hairy garment all over. So they called his name Esau. Afterward, his brother came out and his hand took hold of Esau's heel. So like in the womb, they're like battling it out. And even in birth, like he grabs his heel. So his name was called Jacob, and Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. So married at 40. And so how long were they praying that the Lord would, interesting, right? We read it in a couple of verses, and he prayed, and then like she's pregnant. Okay, great. This is 20 years later. Interesting. Grabs his brother's, you know, foot, his ankle on the way out, his heel on the way out. And so the boys grew. And Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field. But Jacob was a mild man, or some of your translations might even say plain man, dwelling in tents. Now, there's a lot that's worth discussing here with these two. Again, the foreknowledge of God to know what's going to happen, and so him telling her ahead of time what this will be. The Edomites would come through Esau. And, of course, the last known descendants of the Edomites would have been Herod's family. And what do we find from Herod's family? This would be Herod, one of that family that tried to have Jesus and baby Jesus killed, right? So this battle continued. They were antagonistic, towards the people of God. And if you even think about Israel, fast forward, you know, 400 years, leaving Egypt, who met them and fought them along the way? The Edomites. The line of Messiah, right, would have to come through one of these two boys. It's through your descendants that this will happen. Well, it's going to be one of them, and it can't be both. And so just like it, as the line had to come through either Isaac or Ishmael. It couldn't come through both. So it had to be one of those two. It has to be one of these two. And then fast forward again, and what? How many kids will Jacob have? Well, he'll have a bunch of kids, right? And it could only come through one of the 12, what would essentially be the tribes. It's only Judah. It couldn't be the others of them. So predestination, of course, it's very much a New Testament theological reality, but like Jacob and Esau here, prophecy, the prophecy about these two and what we know about predestination, it's foretelling and it's based on foreknowledge. So what do we know about these boys at their birth? Again, there's this battle even before they're born. There's Jacob, his name literally means heel catcher or one who takes the heel. And he would become known and his name would be synonymous with, there's no way around this, as much as Esau isn't like the greatest guy on the planet, man, Jacob was a pretty devious character. You know, Pastor Chuck used to always talk about this, like, you know, you understand why the Lord did not choose Esau, but why the Lord did choose Jacob is beyond me, but he had to choose one of them, and so he did. So devious guy, heel catcher, becomes synonymous with kind of his name and his approach to things. And Esau, again, especially there in verse 27, he was a skillful hunter, a man of the field. He's an outdoorsman, right? And he was a man who didn't seem concerned with anything besides material things, as we'll see specifically in just a few moments. Was he unspiritual? It's an interesting conversation. He was unspiritual, but it was more along the lines of because he was a materially minded man, he didn't really leave much room for any other interests. So it wasn't like he was not full on antagonistic against spiritual things. He was just so consumed with the here and now. And again, as we'll see in just a moment, he didn't have room for further interest. But Jacob, there again, verse 27, was a mild or a plain man, and that literally could be translated complete. And this was he who was chosen to be the namesake for the children of God, for the people of God. The Jacobites? Nope. His name would later be changed by God to, of course, Israel, prince of God, or governed by El, by God. So as much of a kind of a, maybe not shady character, but like whatever the next level up from shady might be, you know, this was him. But man, the Lord so blessed him and so used him. His name changed by God and his name. Interesting, isn't it? You'd think we'll be the Abraham, the people of Abraham. Specifically, it's through Jacob that they'll be called. So Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game. But Rebekah loved Jacob. Okay, so Esau is loved by dad, and I wonder how this conversation would go. Yeah, dad loves me because, you know, I bring home maybe not the bacon so much, but probably the venison, I guess, right? And dad loves that about me. But mom, well, you know, I just love Jacob so much. And man, is this favoritism? You're probably, and that's never a good thing in the family, and so it just adds all these other components to this. Now, Jacob, verse 29, cooked a stew, and Esau came in from the field, and he was weary, he's tired. Esau said to Jacob, please feed me with that same, some of your translations might have red stew. King James, I think, is like, is it porridge maybe? But it's kind of the, if you'll notice, the word stew is probably italicized. That's just there to help us get a better understanding of what's being described here as it's translated from the Hebrew into the English. It was stew, but the literal word is just red. Would you feed me with that same red? It's kind of the red soup, red stew. For I am weary. Therefore, his name was called Edom. But Jacob said, sell me your birthright as of this day. And Esau said, look, I'm about to die. So what is it? Exaggerated much, maybe. So what is this birthright to me? Then Jacob said, swear to me as of this day. So he, Esau, swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. And Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils. Then he ate and drank, arose and went his way. Thus Esau, note this, and again, the foreknowledge of God, how many years later is this? And God, when they're in the womb, recognized the battle that would be here, and Esau despised his birthright. So here's where we really get into a lot of the detail about both of their personalities. Both of their personalities essentially shine through here. And of course, there's this sense with Jacob, right, where he's clever enough to try to make things happen himself, or he's clever enough specifically to try to make things happen without God. This would be, think, Proverbs 3, 5, and 6, you know, lean not on your own understanding. He was an expert in leaning on his own understanding. Like, I got this, man. This is to come to one of us, and it's going to come to me. So, man, I'm going to make sure that I handle this. So two things about Jacob. He was always trying to gain the upper hand, and that's what he does right now. Esau's, you know, worn out. By the way, Esau, and I really do believe that he was exaggerating here, he wasn't starving. Well, how do we know that? This is Abraham and Isaac's family, right? They were not poor. It was probably the kind of thing as he walked in, because they were a wealthy family, Esau simply had nothing prepared. Like, he's out in the field all day, whatever, hunting and everything. Like, man, I'm tired. Oh, hey, bro, you're cooking something? Give me some of that. I will, under one condition, right? Fine, I'm starving to death. Probably exaggerating. So Jacob, always trying to gain the upper hand and trying to make things happen in his own strength, that's part of his character. And this was a great opportunity to try to win the birthright, to buy the birthright from his older brother. Older brother, and the older, verse 23, shall serve the younger. And this is the favorite child of Rebekah. I wonder if she ever mentioned that to Jacob. You know what God told me about you and your brother? Interesting. The other thing about Jacob, though, he also greatly desired the birthright and its blessings and benefits. And no doubt, and this is a whole interesting kind of thing too, as he was a mild or a plain or a complete man there in verse 27, dwelling in tents, he would have therefore spent a lot of time around mom and dad. And so he was more familiar with these things, where Esau's like, I don't know what the Hebrew word might be for whatever, but like, I'm going out, I'm going to go in the field, I'm going hunting, whatever. He just was not interested in that side of things. So that's Jacob, and obviously we'll discuss more about him in the weeks to come. But Esau, or Edom means red. Edom, red, verse 30. Please feed me with that same red, for I'm weary. I weary. I'm exhausted. Literally, the guy is nicknamed after food, right? He comes out, he's red, verse 25. He's hairy all over, and this he's known for a pot of or a bowl of stew. And so as much as Jacob has like got this dichotomy about him, he's interested in spiritual things to some degree, but always trying to make things happen on his own. Not so much with Esau. He is the prototypical materially minded person. And again, unspiritual, yes, but basically he's unspiritual by default. He just doesn't seem to care about anything other than his bodily appetites. Obviously, birthright, it says at the end of the chapter, he despised it. I don't even care about that. I'd rather have a bowl of stew than that, and the blessings and benefits associated with that. It's almost like today, and you can imagine these two boys, imagine a couple of brothers that were, you know, maybe grandfather passed away, and they go up into the attic and they're digging through grandfather's things, and they find grandpa's like old Bible. You can imagine the one brother like, oh man, I'd love to have that. I mean, this is grandpa, and you know, so much of his legacy and blessing from this, like kind of thumbing through, there's notes, grandpa, look what grandpa had to say about John 3:16. And the other brother, it's just an old dumb book. I'd probably just give it away. Like, whoa, it's that kind of thing. One really cares, and the other one, I don't care at all. Like, okay, well, you're the oldest, so you know, you could have it. What do you think? Man, I'll sell it to you for 25 cents. There's your quarter. Thanks, bro. He doesn't care. Esau doesn't care about these things. And so, again, it's not so much necessarily that he's you know, averse to spiritual things, but he's just so consumed with the material, there's no place for the spiritual. Paul the Apostle would say of this kind of person in Philippians chapter 3, if you're a note taker, and verse 19, Philippians 3:19, this kind of person whose end is destruction, whose God, small g, is their belly, and whose end is shame, who set their minds on earthly things. Colossians chapter 3 would tell us to set our minds on things above. But those whose bodily passions and bodily appetites consume them, they set their minds on earthly things. Again, unspiritual, not necessarily in a negative, antagonistic way, but a totally uncaring way. No thought one way or the other of spiritual things. Okay, so we'll close here in just a few, but let's make sure we're clear on what this now what this is now that they're it's not even a bartering kind of a thing. It's just this quick deal. The birthright. What's the deal with the birthright? Like, what is that? And it's fairly foreign to us today, but this was obviously pretty important in that day. Again, if you're a note taker, you can jot down these two references. Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 17. Deuteronomy 21, 17. And then 1 Chronicles chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. I don't want to be here all night, so we won't turn and look at those, but I'll just look at the one. Deuteronomy 21, verse 17. But he shall acknowledge the son of the unloved wife as the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he has, for he is the beginning of his strength, the right of the firstborn is his. So that's just a side note to it. But essentially, there's two main things that comprise the birthright. It was both a material blessing. There would be that double portion of the inheritance would go to them. And here, which is fascinating, as you look at just that first part, the double portion of the inheritance would have gone to Esau. He looks at this and says, I don't actually care. Think about it, just in human terms, like how impatient or... what's the right word here? It's not impatient. Flippant's probably a really good word. Like, I'm hungry now. You have a bowl of soup, of stew. I want it. Yeah, but the birthright, double portion of all dad's stuff, I don't even care. I want food now. Again, Philippians 3:19, whose God is their belly. Like, I don't care about even long-term things. So it's a flippancy about it, but at the same time, it's like, this is illogical. So even the material part, from a materially minded guy, he doesn't even care about the long-term benefits of the material side. Fascinating. The immediacy carried greater importance to him than future material blessing. And secondly, not only the double blessing materially, but the birthright also had a spiritual weight to it. Upon the death of the father, the son with the birthright became the head of the family and the spiritual leader of the family. Esau, again, verse 34, he despised it. So again, there's this kind of double element of he's all about the material things, so he doesn't really care about the birthright. He doesn't care about spiritual things, but as soon as he loses it, now he's kind of mad about it. But think about it, again, not just this double portion and not just the becoming the head of the household spiritually, but for this family, this is Abraham's son's family, that family and the birthright that would come with it, whew, the covenant of God that was made towards Abraham concerning land and nation and the Savior to come, none of which were important to Esau in the slightest. The dude literally just wanted something to eat. So fascinating that this is not so very different. It is, but it's not so very different from the event of chapter 3 when for one bite of desired fruit, Adam and Eve and their descendants to come lost so much. Esau's the kind of guy, as he despised the birthright, he'd be the kind of guy that would almost be offended. Of course, everyone's offended. name an issue over which someone is not offended today, but almost like insulted if someone were to make him any kind, or make any spiritual connection to him. Like, you know, if he were to leave work early, oh, what, are you going to go home and pray? Oh, you're not going to sit with us at lunch? What, are you going to go read your Bible? And like, he'd be insulted by the thought he would be doing something spiritual. If he said something righteous just out of the blue and people like started jokingly calling him, you know, preacher or something, ooh, he would hate it. Despise this stuff. Today, in Testament terms, this is probably what you would label as a carnal Christian. Follow God, kind of, but their walk has never really developed. Sold his birthright to Jacob. Here's a Donald Gray Barnhouse. History shows that men prefer illusions to realities, choose time rather than eternity, and the pleasures of sin for a season rather than the joys of God forever. Barnhouse went on to say, multitudes of men spend more time shaving than on their souls, and multitudes of women give more minutes to their makeup than to the life of the eternal spirit. Men still sell their birthright for a mess of pottage. And again, as it turns out about these two, and specifically about Esau, shocker, right? God was correct. Hebrews chapter 12 will be the last thing for tonight. Hebrews 12 verse 16 says that Esau was a fornicator and a profane person. Again, he gave no thought, had no interest in the things of God. His God was literally his belly, totally given to material appetites, and he therefore excluded himself from the things of God and from God. This is the son of Isaac. Grandpa Abraham, he doesn't care about any of that. Oof. How many people around, and this is, again, by way of application for us today, how many people, this is the Bible Belt. How many people probably fall into a category of an Esau today? Like, yeah, totally that stuff. Just don't ask me to ever get involved. Or, oh, I thought you were going to ask me to pray over a meal. Whew, that was close. They don't want anything to do with it. Happy to probably go to church. Like, yeah, you know, check a box or whatever. Are you Christian? I'm an American, right? It's that kind of thing. But they just don't really care. Oh, may that not be said of us. Lord, thank you for your word. And may, you know, most of, honestly, Jacob's life also not be said of us. May we not insist on taking matters into our own hands. May we not be a deceiver, devious, and lean on our own understanding. We don't want to do that. We want to lean not on our own understanding. We want to trust you. We want to look to you. We want to look to you for your wisdom, your ways. And Lord, help us to, these are tough stories. As we get to see these men and their mistakes, their failures, their faults, their sins, their shortcomings on full display, it's easy to critique them. And this, well, we study your word. You presented their lives as examples for us to learn from them. But Lord, that's the thing, that we're to learn from them so that we might be challenged to believe differently, to believe right, to think differently, and to think rightly. So we want to commit ourselves to you. Thank you for these built-in warnings, actually. May we decide to walk with Jesus all of our days. And Jesus, we ask all of it in your precious name once again. Amen. Have a great night, great rest of your week. Be safe out there. See you later.